Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Futures in Biotech, episode 91. Six PhDs piled high and deep.
I believe that biotech is the next frontier.
Probably the greatest intellectual revolution that's ever taken place in man's history. DNA is the code for life. We're actually beginning to understand how life works, which I think is something that's mind-blowing in and of itself.
There was going to be a genetic component to aging.
How long was there to be the extension?
About 30-40% for humans. That would equate to something like 20 to 30 years.
How close are we to actually having a therapy?
Ballpark, 10 years.
So potentially one of the things that'll end up rocking the world the same way that people said, oh, the sun's the center of the universe, oh, this and that and everything. And now here's somebody who can come out and say, hey, look, here's how we compare it to our closest evolutionary relative.
Welcome to Futures in Biotech. Today, we're going to talk physics, everything that's happened in the last year of physics. And to do so, I've assembled six biologists. Wait a second. No. This is a year-end show. It's time to take a break from actually thinking, and we're going to talk science. We're going to talk life sciences. There'll be a little bit of physics because physics is in the news and we have opinions, even though we have no or virtually no understanding of what's going on in the world of physics. I've got a really great group of people. So let's start by introducing everyone. First, I've got Dr. George Farr, and he's in the studio here with me in Cleveland.
Hi, everybody.
George is VP of Biochemistry in Biophysics at Aromics LLC and Adjunct Professor in the Department of Physiology and Biophysics at Case Western Reserve University. Next, we have panelist number two. We have Dr. Mark Gerstein from Yale University. He's the Albert L. Williams Professor of Biomedical Informatics, Molecular Biophysics and Biochemistry, and Computer Science at Yale University. He's very busy. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you.
On line number three, we have Dr. David Thomas, who is Professor and Chair of the Department of Biochemistry at McGill. Welcome to the show, David.
Hi, Mark.
Just to let everybody know, David was in charge of my PhD. He was my PhD mentor, and
I have no responsibilities to content.
I have to watch out what I say because he can take it away.
Take it away, Mark.
All right. On line number four, we have Dr. Justin Sanchez, and he's the director of the Neuroprosthetics Research Group at the University of Miami. He's been on the show several times, and he moved from northern Florida to southern Florida, and it's been good to you, Justin.
Welcome to the show. Thanks for having me. And hey, you know, I know it's freezing up north right now, so whenever you guys want to come to Miami, you just let me know because it's really nice right now.
Better watch out; we might take you up on that.
Yeah.
Is that to the entire audience or just the chat room?
Hey, sure. No, they have the entire audience. They'll have like a TWiT meetup or something here on South Beach. I think it'll be fun.
That's great.
That would be fun. And at the Brick House, we actually have someone at the Brick House, which is great. We have Simon Melov. He's associate professor at the Buck Institute for Research on Aging. Welcome, yes. Simon.
Good to be here.
Just to let everyone know, you can go back and listen to the show, the shows that we produced in the last part of 2010 and early 2011. And Simon helped produce three episodes on research in aging, which ended up not only being very, very some very good science, but some very scary science in a positive way. You know, paradigm shifting science.
Aging gets to us all.
It does, but, you know, for those that are actually watching, they might take a look here and see Simon looks like a young man, but he's actually 95 years old. So
that joke is so old.
I want some of what he's having. All right, so let's start off. We're going to get George going here. George has prepared a little something in terms of topics. So what we're going to do is we're going to cover various topics, either paper-based or news item-based, and then we're going to have a general discussion and we'll answer questions in the chat room. So, George, what did you want to talk about today?
So, I mean, I wanted to start things off just, you know, real quick. I wanted to take a quick survey of the panel here. When you guys were all in undergraduate and you're in college, what was your major? I was a chemistry major. What was your major, Mark?
Economics and music as a minor for a while till I didn't do too well. Then I switched over to biology.
Interesting path there.
Yes.
How about you, Dave?
I majored in having a good time and minored in biology, I guess, and then went on to physics, yeah. And then genetics, yeah.
And Justin?
Yeah, so I was a biomedical engineering student. So I was kind of on the fence, right? Half bio, half engineer.
Mark number two?
I was a physics major.
So maybe we can have a physics show.
Yeah, we could. And last but not least, wait a second. We got another panel here, member here. Simon?
I'm trying to remember.
He's 95.
Did I have a major? I vaguely remember dabbling in a range of things, but I think the way it worked was we had to focus on one thing, and I think it was biochemistry, but I'm not altogether certain.
Okay. The reason why I ask is because, you know, as a chemistry major, one of the ways that we're sort of, you know, early on introduced to the literature, if you will, is through something called the Chem and Engineering News. It's part of the American Chemical Society. And it's just this little brief publication that talks to you about, you know, all kinds of things in the world of chemistry and engineering. And I was just recently, just for the heck of it, I picked up a recent issue. It was beginning of December. And it had an article that discussed what's being commonly referred to right now as the patent cliff. So we're talking about big pharma. And we're approaching, or actually we're right now in the midst of this big patent cliff. There's something in the neighborhood of, I think, 20 or 30 major drugs that are going to be going off patent in the next year or two. For instance, Lipitor went off patent just a month ago. And that, you know, for Pfizer, that's something like $5 billion of annual sales. So over the course of the next, I think, 2 to 3 years, the big pharma is looking at a loss in revenue of something on the order of $250 billion. So these guys are really looking at a pretty steep cliff. And I just figured, you know, I would raise this issue with you guys and ask you guys what you think about it. What's your take on big pharma and their imminent loss of so much revenue? And you know, I mean, if you think of this, I want to couch this maybe a little bit differently. I mean, this is a show about futures in biotech. And I think that loss of intellectual property, if you will, on the part of big pharma, maybe represents an enormous opportunity for biotech as a whole. And I know, for instance, you, Dave, have, you know, you've got some experience in terms of dealing with some of these companies and such, and you know, you've dabbled here and there and are actually very actively pursuing some things. And I just wanted to get everybody's take on things.
So I'll just jump in real quick here and say our valuation, George, has just gone up 4 times. Okay, David. David Thomas.
It's good times for small biotechs in one way. In another way, the master is the same for you as it is for big pharma, and that's meeting the expectation of your investors and shareholders every quarter. So that's part of the real problem, is that the expectations are very short term, and big pharma has replied to that by increasing market share. So they do a lot of acquisitions, and I guess their model now for innovation, the risky part, is universities. We have several collaborations from our department with big pharma, and also biotechs, and I think all the big pharmas now have at least a program, and even a VC arm at arm's length to actually invest in early stage biotech. But it's demanding, as you know. As you know, at aeromics, is that you really have to have almost a phase one clinical trial before you can really build value into a small molecule.
Can I chip in? I think this is actually it's a really interesting time, but it's also a very dangerous time. And by that, what I mean is all of the low-hanging fruit with regards to sort of human health, I think, is pretty much gone. So what we're left with is all the really hard biomedical problems, aging being amongst them. And as a result, with all this cutting of R&D by Big Pharma, and to a large extent cutting back in the investment in basic R&D at the government level across the world as well due to the economic crisis, we're left with this very bizarre situation of very hard biomedical problems which require sustained, prolonged investment in basic research before we can sort of begin to crack them, and a tremendous increase in the demand for therapies. And so how do we resolve that?
What is the reality? Let me interject here with a question. Yeah. We've got a lag, a little bit of a lag. What is the... What is the sort of the federal in Canada and in the United States policy on funding the NIH and the CIHR? What politician would cut cancer research? I mean, how does somebody go up and say, I've cut cancer research because we need to balance the budget? Out of all the things that are considered sacred cows, shouldn't it be medical research? And is that the actual case? I'm asking, have the budgets at the federal level in both countries gone up or down based on this recent economic downturn?
Well, I think we saw yesterday that there probably will be a bit more money for the NIH. The CHR is not cutting back on its funding programs as such. But, you know, the usual response to something like this, and I guess I've been around enough to see this. I certainly wasn't around in the 50s, but I hear that there was a remark from the chairman, the first head of the NCI in the U.S., Dusty Rhodes, who said, hey, cancer is cured. We've got chemicals. That was mustard gas. We have radiation, and we have surgery. Cancer's over. And here we are 60 years later, and we're still looking at cancer as a major, major killer. The argument governments use is we need to translate more of this research into patient care, and that's a reasonable one. Priming the pump, governments are just as bad as companies at choosing what avenues to take in research to cure a problem or to solve a problem. And so that's really on investigators on R01s and operating grants, you know, individual operating grants that really come up with these things. So I don't know. It's a problem that goes and comes back, and it will always come back, I think.
So, Mark, just speaking about the funding levels, the NIH may have gotten a little bit of a bump, but compared to the growth, right, within academic institutions that's occurring, the increase in the federal budget towards research has not grown proportionally, right?
Okay.
So I would say that that's also a tremendous issue, right? There needs to be a way to support, sustain the continued growth within academia.
Well, I think what George is proposing here is, when companies lose their pipelines, their revenue, and they're in their final maybe year and a half of a patent, and a revenue from a drug, an HIV drug, which could be $500 million a quarter, if that becomes off patent, then they can't reformulate it. There's nothing they can do to that drug to get it back on patent. They're going to be scrambling to buy up small biotech companies that have developed compounds, even at earlier stages. Maybe they'll have a chemical that has passed a mouse model, but it hasn't gone past more robust, larger mammal models or human trials, toxicity trials even.
Or work these partnerships and collaborations.
So this
things
might,
along those lines. I mean, I think that there's going to be a greater opportunity for biotech to... I mean, it's going to continue. I mean, it's already been the case that
there's been increased opportunity for the biotech sector. And I think part of the reason why the biotech sector is so robust right now is because there has been an opportunity, because pharma has been pulling away, you know, gradually from, I shouldn't even say gradually, I mean, over a bunch of years here, they've been pulling away from a lot of basic science. And I think it's going to continue to grow as they lose an enormous amount of revenue. I think they're going to scramble even more. And so I see it as just a huge opportunity.
I think the technology where it's at is getting more and more accessible to smaller companies. You know, actually getting your DNA sequenced for your clones, that you just send them off and it's $7 a pop, right? So you can actually get through some of the science cheaper. And if you decide to go with a small biotech model, you don't have the university overhead. Although it might be harder to pull in the talent. If you're at McGill or at Yale, you can pull in some serious talent.
But I mean, how about the complexity issue? I mean, coming back to what I said earlier, the problems we're facing now are really difficult ones, and I'm not sure. Even though there's been withdrawal of funding and infrastructure for clinical trials from Big Pharma, that biotech can take up that slack because they've got an even more constrained set of outlooks than pharma did with regards to developing new drugs and therapies, because the problems are so much harder. And you add to that this pressure from the political side of things, where you've got an explosive growth in the baby boomers and all their age-related diseases, creating a real sustained pressure to develop cures rapidly, but a withdrawal of funding for all the basic research mechanisms because of other pressures, and I don't know whether it's a tenable situation. I'm not altogether optimistic.
You've picked one of the most difficult long-term quests of working on aging and moving human lifespan for various very important reasons, delaying the onset of age-related diseases and improving quality of life for seniors and lowering their medical costs. That is indeed a very a difficult challenge, but there's a lot of low-hanging fruit in terms of novel drug targets and novel methodologies that can be applied to the clinic that large pharma traditionally don't touch because they aren't demonstrated targets. And they usually, the standard model for pharma is to come in and spend $100 million and just acquire a pipeline that's already shown a doability or a validation. So I think we're maybe at just the right time to set up those collaborations and sort of, you know, large pharma have had a traditional model of letting other people do the hard work. And there's a lot of easy work out there. You look at a disease like multiple sclerosis, right? And identifying which, so everybody with MS might have a different antibody that's attacking the Schwann cells in their CNS, central nervous system. Now, identifying what that epitope is recognized by their personal antibody is a very, very difficult thing to do, or was. Now there are libraries available where you can screen somebody's serum for which peptide might go and inhibit that interaction. And those technologies are becoming easy. I'm surprised somebody hasn't started a company to screen MS patients with for the epitope for their autoimmune disorder or for all autoimmune diseases. I mean, this is a low-hanging fruit.
I'm not disagreeing with you on that, Mark. What I'm talking about is I absolutely accept that niche markets are there to be exploited and grabbed hold of and capitalized on. What I'm talking about is the aggregate health burden, the diseases which are driving the healthcare costs going through the roof. And that, you know what they are. They're cancer, they're heart disease, they're all the age-related neurodegenerative diseases, which are enormously difficult problems. And those are the ones which are having the funding withdrawn, and really big pharma is stepping away from them. They don't want to touch these things with a 10-foot pole anymore. They're contracting. They're looking for these kinds of opportunities you're talking about, niche markets where they can make a little bit of money, and maybe if they spread it over a range of disorders which affect small sectors of the population, maybe they can make up some of that shortfall in terms of their blockbuster drugs as they go off the patent cliff. But really, that doesn't address the big healthcare problems, which is facing the entire planet at the moment. So that's what I was talking about.
Simon, if I could jump in, you know, so I have two things to say. One kind of facetious. Yeah, so maybe we should stop aging research, because a lot of these diseases, of course, are the diseases of the old. You got to die of something, so dying earlier might be an advantage economically. That was the facetious thing. The more serious thing is, when there are targets which are new and novel, which are presented, and I'm thinking of the sirtuins that I'm sure you know a lot more about than I, they actually, when they hit there was a company, in fact, Sirtris, I think, that was bought by GSK. When they actually hit the clinic or the trials, sometimes these compounds don't work out. And
we can talk about that later.
Yeah, right. Well, I think maybe we should, because I think that's a kind of an interesting inverse case, if you like, of what farmers should be doing. And maybe they're going to feel a little bit more nervous now about taking things up from biotech companies.
Let's come back to that. It's a very interesting situation.
Yeah. Mark, I see a question from the chat room.
All right. What is the question? Let's interject, then we'll go to Mark, and then we'll come back to it. But go ahead. What was the question?
Is it true that exercise keeps a person looking younger than they really are?
Who asked the question?
It was a loquacious one.
All right. Let's ask Simon.
Speaking about aging, right?
Yeah. So there's a very simple answer to that, although we don't have any magic bullets which can wind back the clock or stop the clock at the moment. The one thing we do have is changing your lifestyle. And it's absolutely true that regular exercise will slow the incidence of all age-related disease. And it will keep you functioning longer. There's some fascinating studies coming out of Stanford where they've been tracking people for nearly 30 years. One group of people who've been exercising regularly, another group of people who have not been exercising regularly. And the survival curves are splitting like this now after nearly 30 years. And so the people who are exercising regularly, and just moderate exercise, not a great deal of exercise, but the people who are exercising regularly are living longer, and it's a much better effect than, for example, giving up smoking. So it has a profound effect on your ability to resist age-related diseases and live a better quality life. The difficulty is doing it, and that's what most people have trouble following, that discipline of exercising three or four times a week. So that's the status quo, as it were, on exercise and aging. It really is extremely beneficial at reducing the incidence of all age-related disease, not just cardiovascular disease, but cancer, neurodegenerative disease, arthritis, all of these things.
Well, should we tax cars as being a sin tax? Because you'd be healthier if you didn't. So let's come back to age, because I think we should perhaps close the show with a discussion of some of the very important implications of research on aging. Let's take the conversation to Mark Gerstein at Yale. Did you have a news item or a paper that you wanted to discuss?
Oh, sure. Well, I guess for me the big thing of the last year has really been, you know, the growth in personal genomes and personal genomics. I actually wouldn't, you know, I was thinking about it, I wouldn't actually point to a specific paper. What I would actually point to, which made a big impact on me, was there's this company in California called Complete Genomics. And, you know, I remember, you know, during the year, they just released this load. I think it was 69 genomes or some number like that to the public. And I was really quite impressed with them doing this with very little fanfare and so forth. And it you know, I think that scale of data and, you know, that, amount of information on personal genomes has really made quite a lot of impact on me.
What about George Church's project to do he wanted to get 1,000 genomes by the end of the year?
Genome Project.
Yeah.
PGP.
What stage is that at right now? Because we did a show with him, and we were trying to get Leo's genome sequence so that we could all figure out how you broadcast, what are the broadcast genes. But
Well, I think that, I mean, I think that they have, I mean, I don't know the exact numbers, but I think they have many, many people that they've done their genomes, and they've also done lots of exomes, and, you know, they're actually accumulating lots of information about people. I think that's a great project, and I, you know, I think, you know, for me, I'm, you know, extremely excited about this, you know, whole world of personal genomics and so forth.
So, Mark, can I ask a question here? What do you think about the I think I'm paraphrasing here. I might not have the exact sentence right, but I think it was Elaine Mardis who recently said the $1,000 genome, the $1 million analysis. Yeah, I mean, we're just being deluged with massive amounts of information on these personal genomes, but we don't really have a good way of analyzing that data yet.
Well, no, I think that's definitely. I mean, that's definitely true, and of course. You know, since I'm, you know, focused on very much the analysis, I'm extremely enthusiastic about that because, you know, it there's really lots and lots of opportunities to do interesting analysis. And I think it's even more extreme than the $1,000 genome and the $1 million analysis. I mean, I think that the term people have been using more and more is that the cost of sequencing very soon will essentially go to zero. I mean, it will be free, you know, and the analysis and well, the analysis will be, you know, certainly a lot of money. The other big thing, is, of course, is procuring samples and, you know, finding interesting things to sequence, you know, biologically interesting and so forth.
I've got a question for you, Mark. Does, like, you know, having your genome, it's much like when you start graduate school in 1993, you sequence a gene, now you have a PhD, whereas in by 1998, you had to show function. Right, you had so relevant function. Is it at a point right now where you can sequence a genome? It's very easy, but unless you have like a sort of a, some other analysis can correlate to that genome, for example, someone's personal health and the health of their offspring, isn't that where the value of the genomics really lies in the medical records and the e-records now? And wouldn't that take us another 10 years to look at long-term effects of various genes and get a functional analysis of a genome? Is that where it's going?
Sure. No, I mean, I think it is definitely the case that I think obviously more and more there's going to be, you know, how should I say, the bar to publishing things is going to get higher and higher, and you're going to have a substantial amount of functional data or medical relevance and whatnot to publish things. And I think that, you know, I think it's more and more that, you know, just sequencing is going to be a service or just something that happens, you know, sort of in the background. But I think that's a great thing. I mean, I think that it will really be a great, you know, lots of great opportunities for us all.
Do you think it will translate to being useful, you know, having the genome? Once we have, say, 20 years of data on, you know, maybe 100,000 families, not just their genomes, but genomes of 100,000 families where we've got 400,000 or 500,000 genomes and their family records. Do you think that will translate to a revolution in personalized medicine?
Well, I don't know about the word revolution, but I think that I really do think that it will lead to something. So I think that there will be, you know, just so much information, genetic information out there about people that, I think just by sheer dint of simple correlations with all that, we'll find, you know, some interesting things. You know, each person will find some interesting things about themselves, and, you know, there'll be some interesting aggregated, observations. I mean, the thing that is amazing, I'm really impressed with, is just the amount of high quality information. I mean, if you just look at, a paper from, say, 1975 or something that's published in literature, and you kind of analyze how much information is actually in that paper, and, you know, all the figures they have in the paper, you know, how precisely are they known and so forth. You know, there's a certain aliquot of information, and it's just incredible now how much, you know, really precise and really accurate information you can get. You know, from all this sequencing and so forth, and not just about humans, about things in, you know, things in general.
Matt, can I ask another question of Mark? So, with the, I mean, there's a lot of optimism about, well, if we sequence more, we're going to get insights into everything. But I always think about the experience of Decode Genetics, which did an incredible job at at saturating Iceland looking at the health records in conjunction with very detailed genetic analysis of every single person in Iceland. And they really didn't get that much out of it, is my understanding of it.
I would actually slightly disagree. I mean, I don't have at my fingertips all of Decode's accomplishments, but they really discovered some lots of interesting genetic facts about people. I mean, one thing that comes to mind is I think they had a very interesting paper about some very large inversion that they discovered that certain people harbored. It was quite amazing how big that inversion was. I think the interesting thing about Decode is despite really very good science, they were very unsuccessful as a company. I mean, you know, if you look at all the papers they published in really good journals that were really, really associated with real science, and you look at how they did financially compared to their competitors like, say, 23andMe or Navigenics or whatnot, it's quite amazing, I think.
But didn't they, I mean, my sort of recollection of it was they went into this project expecting to find major loci responsible for a large proportion of disease, you know, whatever disease they were looking at. And they really didn't find that genes were responsible, per se, for a lot of the disease which they were going after. They had very small, modest effects. And although they were scientifically interesting, they didn't translate into major breakthroughs in terms of targets and developing new drugs for those diseases. And that's where the disappointment came in.
I think that's definitely true. I mean, that's also been, in a sense, you know, the message that people have gotten in general from all these genome-wide association studies. I mean, you know, I think they're interesting, and they do show things that are statistically true. But again, it's not like they're going to cure cancer or they're going to really make a profound difference in healthcare. And I, you know, on the other hand, I think incrementally over the years, if you add all these studies up, I do think they are going to make a difference.
I'm going to just change my audio. Apologize. You hear me? So one of the I'm going to jump in and say it's about the metadata. I think it's going to take just a little time, like it did with the human genome, to really move modern medicine to give us information that we just didn't have. And a lot of the work that Mark is doing at coming up with methodologies to look at entire genomes and really mine them for data is really at the forefront forms the foundation of this. But once you add medical histories and you can start to make serious correlations and predictions as to what the conditions people might have, tap it onto everybody's personal proteome, where you look at every individual protein under the various disease states, non-disease states, conditions, timing, organ-specific. I think that's when you end up with a strategy that you can, you know, load up into a tricorder and have instant vision of that person's medical state. But I don't know. My question goes to Mark on this being very easy to do. What is your view on security? If somebody can sequence a genome for free, they're walking through Walmart. Wouldn't you want to also correlate the metadata as to their consumer behavior?
Yeah, no, I'm very interested in that question. I mean, I'm really fascinated by all the security and privacy implications of you know, all this large amounts of data that people are generating in their lives. And it's not just, you know, genomics. I mean, you know, obviously people are accumulate all sorts of information about themselves, whether it's, you know, pictures or, you know, profiles or whatnot they have on the computer. And I do think it is interesting what's happening, you know, in society and the way people can mine this information. I mean, you know, obviously you probably heard a lot about this in relation to more advertising and, you know, what the different, computer companies are doing to kind of track people and sort of serve them with very personalized ads and experiences and so forth. But I do think this is going to become more and more prevalent. And I do think that it's potentially a very serious problem when connected to, you know, to genetics and something as fundamental as that.
I'd like to know Dave Thomas's take on this.
Well, it was one of my topics, actually, that I was going to discuss. I'm going to have to talk about broccoli now.
That's okay. Segue to your section.
It's not the first time there has been huge amounts of data. You know, you only have to think about astronomy. And they find ways, people that work on hydrodynamics, there have been ways, very good ways developed to handle the data physically and to analyze data. So I'm sure that will come. I think the more interesting issues are exactly the ones that Mark and Mark have brought up, which are the how this data will be used. For example, we will probably encounter things that say something like, well, you have a predisposition to getting fat, restrict your diet. And so that'll work, right? If we tell people that, getting obese will give them health problems. We don't need a genome to do that, right? Right?
Well, that's true, but I think it's one would hope that a lot of these things would become more specific. I mean, I think you're going to see this more at the extremes. Like I think it's going to be more like if you're interested in being a marathon runner or if you're interested in being a sports player, people are going to look at your sequence and they're going to say, look at your the variants you have for say things associated with your muscles. I think there's a particular genetic
twitch. Yeah.
Well, and you know, I think that's going to have an impact on your life if you decide to, you want to pursue being a runner or be a, go into a particular endeavor. I mean, you know, I think, you know, people would think twice, geez, you know, I maybe don't have the genetic composition to be, a super fast marathon runner or lift great weights and whatnot. And I think that will change what they'll do with their life. Now that's the extreme, but I think you'll see this in other type of fields too.
You know, years ago there was always this sort of IQ inheritance versus nature versus nurture argument. How do you, Mark, envisage that now? Here we will now see the gene for whatever, and people with high IQs or low IQs will have more of this. Will this open up a new Pandora's box of discrimination? And
I'm particularly worried about that. And I think that the other Mark was getting that at a little bit in relation to some of the privacy and security things that he was pointing out. I mean, I think that there's all sorts of, although I'm extremely enthusiastic about this information, I also tend to be very worried about things. I'm a natural worrier. But I think that, you know, genetics has had a long history of all sorts of abuses and a long history of all sorts of worrisome things. And now I think if you couple that with all this data, right, I think you can just kind of see that this is something to think about or to worry about or something, because it's just not clear that just given the history of what's happened with genetics, if all this large amounts of genetic data out there is necessarily going to lead to, I don't say good outcomes, but I think it could lead to all sorts of, worrisome things. And I think that was a bit what Mark was getting at.
Yeah.
Well, if somebody has an active form of or constitutively active form of PPAR gamma or something of the sort, there might be a situation where I'll sell them running shoes. I'm being absurd here, but instead of focusing on dietary requirements of somebody that is obese, you could focus it towards somebody that has clearly a fast active metabolism, somebody who doesn't require a whole lot of preconditioning but has it.
But won't this also have really be more oriented towards educating the public about genetics? Because I mean, we're talking about as though there are genes for this or genes for that. In reality, these things work in aggregate. So you won't have a gene for this. You'll have a gene which contributes a tiny fraction of the variance for that particular trait. And then you might have something else which offsets that or whatever. But really, that's our job, right, to try and educate the public and the sort of the administrative officials as to the fact of sort of the modern genetics, that there aren't genes for this or genes for that.
No, I let me jump in, Simon. I think there are. Well, I think one thing that we've discovered over the past 15 years is that there are single genes that, if activated or inactivated, can have dramatic effects on downstream pathways that lead to global organismal level phenomenon, right? We were talking the sirtuins just as an example, and we'll get back to that, but there are single genes that can lead to marathon mice, for example, where you activate
I think you're wrong. There's no, I would definitely disagree with you in terms of deterministic. So genes don't act by themselves, they act in combination with the environment, and you know, just because you have a particular allele does not mean you are fated to be you know, a certain way, and I'm excluding Mendelian traits here, right? I mean, it's obvious if you're talking about, you know, Huntington's disease or something like that.
Let me interject here a little bit. You know, the whole pharma model of producing a pill that will benefit someone usually goes by inactivating a single protein or inactivating pretty much a single enzyme. So if we're looking at the one I'm working on, it's water channel in the brain, and if we hit it, we should be able to reduce the brain water permeability. That person becomes immune to stroke, or at least from the brain damage caused by stroke. There are situations, I think, where a little bit of sequencing can go a long way. Although you're right, I have to agree, it won't. Doesn't mean somebody with an active PPA or gamma is not going to get fat if he sits on his butt all the time and eats 12,000 calories. It just means that he'll have to eat 12,000 calories because his metabolism is extremely robust. It's really interesting. I'll go ahead, Simon.
What I'm getting at is the notion, which you often see in the popular press, that genes are deterministic, and they're absolutely not deterministic. I mean, it's a combination, right? I mean, we all know that. And genotype plus environment equals phenotype. And although there are situations, mostly with Mendelian traits, that they are deterministic, the kinds of things we're talking about being an outcome of sequencing whole genomes, where you're associating very specific changes in the genome with a specific trait, those things are not deterministic. Those things are more likely to be contributing a small proportion of the variance which gives rise to your response to some specific situation or some phenotypic outcome, with whether it's muscle strength or anything else. So that's what I'm getting at, is what's likely to come out of the whole genome sequencing is lots of little aggregate effects, not big major effects. And that's consistent with the big studies which have been done, not with whole genome, but like I mentioned earlier, with deCODE, where they found lots of little effects, which were interesting biologically, but really didn't translate into, you know, big therapeutic gains in heart disease or cancer or anything else.
Yeah. Well, that's true, but I also think there's a sense that if you sequence an entire person's genome, right, you get all these little effects, right? You get all these little variants, and you have them all, right? And then you can, you know, add them up in a sense. Now, this is all very rough, to maybe find a very big proclivity for that person. And I think people haven't been able to do that yet, and they haven't really figured out how to properly do that. But I think that's potentially what's possible, right? I mean, if you'll find a person has, 10 variants, each of them, if you think of them individually, only give them, a slight predisposition to contracting a particular type of cancer. But, you know, if you find all of those things, I think it's a different story, and I think that's what you'll get from this very large scale sequencing.
David is awfully quiet, and
I was thinking actually one of the more interesting, just straight genomic things that came out this year was it was, I think, from Baylor, which was talking about DOPA responsive dystonia in twins, and they were non-identical twins, and the one child was not responding to DOPA and the other one was. I think that was the... And the when the they were sequenced, they realized that one of the kids children had another gene that, let's think, it was something to do with 5-hydroxytryptophan. I can't remember exactly. I think it was, must have been some reductase gene or something was different. So they reduced or they changed the DOPA level, the level of DOPA treatment to that child, and that child improved too. Yeah, I think it was in Science earlier this year. And that was just solely based on sequencing, sequencing of non-identical twins, and then comparing with the genome sequences that are out there, that they kind of unraveled this.
There have been a number of examples.
Right now, I'm trying to Google it right now.
There have been a number of examples akin to what you just said,
yeah,
in terms of success with personalizing medicine from genomes. That's true. But usually those are cases where there's a strong, an unknown disease maybe, and they're looking for some mutation in a specific pathway, and they find that by tweaking a certain, metabolic therapy, they can improve the condition. But as an overall strategy, when you're looking at a large population, you can't discount the impact of environment, which is huge. On phenotypic outcomes.
Exercise, as we've been talking in pre-show, exercise can dramatically extend lifespan on general population, as you mentioned. So environment, definitely, and behavior. I'm going to shift gears. Let's go to Justin. He's been way too quiet, and we got to throw him into the...
I've been on the chat room here.
and we have a hard close at 5 p.m., so let's get Justin in. And then we'll chew the rag on the topics. Go for it, Justin.
Yeah. So I'm going to bring in my whole neuroprosthetics perspective here. This 2011 definitely seemed like a big year for the bionic human. There were two huge stories that came out across every media news source that was out there about bionic humans doing really extraordinary things. One was a story about a guy who was paralyzed. He was a paraplegic, and there was a spinal cord stimulator placed inside of his body, and he was able to take a few steps after this spinal cord stimulator was placed in there. And I'm going to put up the link on the chat room. Let me see if I can find it here.
Maybe Liz can click on the link.
Let me see. I'll post it right now. There was this story, and it's quite remarkable. And one of the reasons why I feel it's really remarkable is that when I first got into science, things like this were of the science fiction realm. And it's really exciting, to live through a time where we see people actually doing stuff like this and it making a difference in somebody's life. And it really opens the door for the possibilities for things that could happen in the future.
Do you see us? So I see you just walk outside, business building, and you see everybody staring at their phones. Are the way we're interacting with our environment and the way we're we're extending our capabilities to communicate at with different methodologies, and basically the human life is dramatically changing, even without necessarily implanted devices, but things that we interact with. Do you see this transitioning to an integrated system, sort of Borg-ish? And or is it only medical applications?
No. I mean, I see it impacting many different parts of our lives. I see technology and our ability to access technology in a variety of ways. I see this is going to be expanding in the future. Right. Right now, typically, all of our technology is external to the body, and the way that we interact with it is through a physical means. But I think that times are changing, and the way that we communicate and interact with these kinds of devices is definitely going to expand. And again, that opens up possibilities for the kinds of things that we could potentially do.
Don't you put wireless chips in human brains with like 100 electrodes, and then they can relay intent and communicate with external devices?
Yeah, let me put another. I just posted another story. So that was the second story, really, that came out this year. There was a fully paralyzed person that had some electrodes that were implanted into their brain, and they were able to use or to think about controlling a very dexterous prosthetic arm. So this was the robotic arm that was developed by Dean Kamen at DECA. There was a wonderful story about that. I don't know if you can click on the link there.
Yeah. No longer available.
The story went down. Okay.
Yeah.
let me see if I can find it in another place. Yeah.
Sure.
Go ahead.
The point I was mentioning to the audience is that the world of bionics is really growing, and Justin is actually doing some serious brain-machine interface devices. But I interrupted someone. Was it that David?
I just posted the link one more time. So this one works, I believe.
Go ahead. This is Mark. One thing I was curious, too, is, you know, I've heard that in addition to implanting devices that people can sense better with, they'll be able to implant in people like almost like RFID chips or things so that you can sense someone else. Does that make any sense?
So what was it? Using an RFID for sensing
I've heard that in addition to, so you're talking about implanting things into someone that would, I guess, in some sense, potentially enhance their senses or enhance their, motor ability and so forth. But I'm just curious also, I've heard that it might also be possible to implant in people very trivially, just like right under their skin, things like little RFID chips and stuff like that, so that if you like walk up to a door, it will open, or if you walk up to something, it will know about you or something. I don't know if I'm making any sense.
Yeah, there's actually a guy in England who actually did something like that. His name is, I believe, Kevin Warwick, and he implanted one of these kinds of chips into his arm and was able to interact with other things in the environment with that kind of chip. Just this whole, again, I see the landscape of science changing tremendously with our ability to interact with both the nervous system, muscles, you know, whatever part of the body that you can really think of, and then not only understanding how those systems work, but then extracting information from them and enabling us to affect our environment in different ways, right? Mm-hmm. And, we're in the realm right now where, you know, people that are disabled are really benefiting from these things, but there's nothing, you know, to say that able-bodied individuals can't also benefit from them.
Let me ask you a question, Justin. Do you see a time, like, because there's no limit once the boxes or the opener or the door is open? Could you, for example, you have a wireless chip that's has the ability to transmit intent from one individual, but then a receiver in as a neuro implant, neuroprosthetic in another person that can receive that intent and sort of interpret it. Right, one that's more passive, and then if you had both sides of the coin, you could have two siblings. An older brother just thinks, "Little brother, go change the channel." Right,
right. No. This whole idea of a sensory, right? How we sense information, where we get that information from, and it's completely conceivable that information could also come from another individual. There are lots of scientific challenges associated with that, right? How does one encode the information? How does one interpret the information? How do you deliver it to the body or to the brain in a meaningful way? So there's a lot of work that still needs to be done.
Well, you're doing it, though. That's
oh, the, yeah, the, it's the, going
go
on.
Go read some of Justin's papers, Justin C. Sanchez in PubMed, and look at some of the stuff he's doing. And I think if humanity goes from a point of being just a living organism to an engineered organism, as it can, we're going to see some very, very interesting changes in the next 100 years.
Yeah, it's going to be really exciting. And again, just in the kind of, you know, if we're doing a year evaluation here, seeing two big stories like these ending up in the mass media and really capturing the attention of a lot of people and the imagination of a lot of people, I think that says a lot for how this field of science and technology is growing. So I'm really excited. I mean, it's a field that I work in, but again, it's kind of seeing something come to reality that once started off as is almost a dream.
So it's happening. I can't wait to have a neuroprosthetic implant. I'd love to be able to, you know, send a text by thinking about it, but not even, what if it had like 3G, right? So send a text, it's 3G, and all I did is think about it. Why have to tell my car, send text to David Thomas, right? Just, done, right? This is the beauty of doing this show and why I appreciate it so much, is that this stuff is really... it's sci-fi. It's happening now, and we get the chance to talk to the people who actually do it. So I'm gonna shift gears again a little bit because we're heading towards. We have about 11 minutes left. So I'd like to get Simon's story in, and then we can, you know, at any time, people in the chat room, go ahead and ask questions, and I'll try to interject and get them in. But we were talking a little bit. Everything always seems to revolve towards the ultimate goal in the engineering of life is to extend human lifespan. So it's I think a good point to end the show with, and I'll pass the baton over to Simon.
Hello. Yes.
well, we're not professional broadcasters, by the way. That's all. Yeah. Check.
Yeah, there were. I actually had a list of areas I thought the year had several highlights in. Unfortunately, they're not highlights for the reasons which you would hope for. So we had several major attractions over the course of a year with regards to aging research. The first one, which received a lot of popular press coverage, was this paper which was published last year in Science about exceptional signatures in long-lived centenarians, so exceptional genetic signatures. So the bottom line of that particular story was that this group published a paper in Science purporting to show that there were regions of the genome which were uniquely associated with people who lived for more than 100 years or so. As it turned out, there was some very substantial technical problems in the study, which were almost immediately uncovered by statisticians and geneticists working in sort of related fields. And it took about a year, but this year the paper has been retracted. Now, that hasn't deterred the investigators who sort of are still maintaining their passion and focus on this area and are hoping to uncover other types of genetic signatures for long life. And as I was saying earlier, I don't think there's any question that there are genes which are associated with long life. And it appears from a whole variety of genetic studies that maybe 30% of your lifespan is dictated by genetics, but the other 70% is dictated by what you do in your life. So that seems to be an emerging consensus. The other sort of area which I thought was...
So Simon, yes. Could I make a quick comment here? Yes. You know, earlier in the chat room, we were talking about lifespan and expectancy and things like that. And, you know, one of the things that really intrigues me about the study of long lives is maybe how we could couple that to space exploration and things like that, right? We have this really tough problem of we want to go long distances, right, to these other places. You can either build a better rocket or you could try to extend your lifespan, right? Well, so are there people talking about these things?
Well, not in the areas I work in. But
while we're speculating here at the end of the year, you know, I thought it's just kind of an intriguing idea.
Yeah, I heard someone discussing the idea recently or read someone discussing the idea recently. They actually thought a good way of expanding the possibility of getting Mars exploration sort of more fully realized was to send older people there so they could live out their lives there and they wouldn't have to worry about coming back.
Coming back, right.
So I thought that was an interesting take on what to do about the baby boomers.
But, it just so happens that the best astronauts are reaching the 80s now, so... People that who could actually have the capacity to do these flights, you know, I interviewed Buzz Aldrin on a show about 3 years ago, and he was explaining to JPL, this was off air, how to develop a heat shield whereby you could still test the engines that you're going to use to come back to get off Mars, with the presence of that heat shield, and he's going into this intricate design, rocket design, and you know, here he is in his at the time, I think 78 or 75, somewhere between 75 and 78, he would be the guy to send up there. So he wouldn't have to come back. That's a fantastic idea.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you certainly save on supplies if they don't have to come back. So there we are. But anyway, coming back to what the other sort of major area of sort of controversy, I think, in the aging field was, I think there's a growing feeling that the sort of Sirtuin bubble has burst. There was a lot of interest initially, and to be honest, I'm not entirely sure that this was fueled, that the interest in Sirtuins was not unduly fueled by the purchase of GSK of Certrus, which was for nearly $1 billion, basically. They purchased
$700 million.
Well, that was an asking price, but there were milestones after that. So it ended up being over $1 billion, I think, in total. Now, what's happened since then, so that was in, I think, 2007 or so. What's happened since then is they still have a number of clinical trials ongoing, that company. And they're all for aging-related diseases. They discontinued one clinical trial because of potential complications in the kidneys of the group they were studying for myeloma, I think. But more than that, there was a piece which appeared in Science, I think 2 or 3 weeks ago, which discussed the whole sort of controversy around sirtuins and whether or not they actually have any impact on aging at all. And so there are really two camps now where some people are minimizing the sirtuins as being really just a fairly average member of a class of genes which numbers in the hundreds now, which can modulate lifespan in simple invertebrates and potentially even in mice. And really doesn't have any major effect on lifespan beyond a few percent. And then you have the other camp, which is essentially tied into the sort of the Certrus model, and they're associated with pushing the idea that these molecules which can interfere in the sirtuin biology are going to have major effects on age-related disease and possibly even lifespan, although there's no evidence that interfering in these pathways in mammals, in wild-type mammals, has any effect on lifespan. There's some pretty interesting data out of Rafa DiCabo's lab where he feeds mice a very specific diet, which is extremely high fat. So these mice are like balls. They're spheres. And when you give them some of these analogs of resveratrol, then they have a reduced incidence of some aspects of age-related disease. But that model is a very sort of strange model. You're treating very obese animals as being normal. And now some may argue that's the average American public. But I don't know whether that's a good model to start from and say, well, here's the new normal. Let's go from that and see if we can develop drugs from that perspective. So this piece in Science a few weeks ago really almost could have been in like GQ or Vanity Fair. I mean, it was so oriented towards the personalities involved in the Sirtuin story, which is people like David Sinclair, Lenny Guarenti, and then you've got these other people who mostly came out of Lenny Guarenti's lab, actually, the sort of the anti-Sirtuin stories, people like Matt Kaeberlein, and the whole story was focused around personality. So it was a very peculiar piece. It wasn't very scientific in a way. It was more sort of, ooh, there's people fighting. Let's cover the fight. So that's kind of what that was like. But on the plus side, there have been some really interesting studies come out, one from the Van Dersen group from the Mayo and a variety of other places, where they engineered a mouse to get rid of senescent cells. And this is a very new approach, the idea that these cells, which if you go back for a few podcasts, Mark and I interviewed a colleague of mine, Judy Campisi at the Buck Institute, and she's pioneered this concept of cellular senescence and the idea that you accrue these cells as you get older, which secrete these inflammatory factors which mediate age-related disease and maybe even aging itself. But this group published this paper in Nature just a few weeks ago where they could actually selectively destroy these senescent cells, and they had a very substantial increase or improvement in a number of features of aging in these mice. And this has really created a lot of excitement, the idea that you can target senescent cells in vivo. And senescent cells, we all get them as we get older. They're pretty nasty. They, in general, are thought to have a generally bad effect, and there's not a good side to them. But that was really pretty exciting, and there have been a whole range of genomic studies which are really pretty interesting, but probably shouldn't take up too much more time. But we can talk about this for ages. So.
What we're going to do is we're going to do a whole new series in January. Let's get back into the big science on aging. I think, you know, if you could, you guys are sort of covering it from every angle. And if you cover senescence and you cover metabolism and you cover, some of the genome issues with respect to stability of the genome, you know, it really is going to change our perspective and the social, the implications on social policy, public policy are dramatic, right? It's a first world problem.
It's a global problem now, Mark. I mean, I think the statistics are that every country pretty much, there's a very substantial majority of the world is aging exponentially now, and this is going to become a very big problem, particularly in some of the more longer or more established democracies. Japan, even China actually has a big aging problem. So there's really I'm not very optimistic about this because the timeline is so short now. And the amount of time required to develop new and effective therapies is really going to be long. I don't see miracle drugs coming in 5 years or 10 years. I used to say that, but I don't say that anymore.
Right, right. Well, we're going to have to send you back to the lab, I guess. It's 2:00 Pacific time, so snap, snap. You know, we've already spent, as scientists, it's very hard to get out of the lab and hard to get out of the research. And I appreciate everybody's time coming in today. And taking sharing us their time and their thoughts. I think a lot of the topics we covered today are going to become topics of the new year. It's one of the reasons why I do this. It allows me to sort of pin down where the frontiers of biotechnology are going. And although what always amazes me is that those lines between science and sci-fi are blurring. And so we're going to have to explore those blurred lines over the next year. I think we're going to have to close. TNT's coming on soon, and I'd like to be able to get to thank everybody for coming on. First, I'd like to thank Dr. George Farr, who is VP of Biochemistry and Biophysics at Omics, for coming on. He had to step out, and he wishes happy holidays to everyone in the audience and to the cast and crew of Futures in Biotech. I'd also like to thank Dr. Mark Gerstein, Albert L. Williams, Professor of Biomedical Informatics, Molecular Biophysics, Biochemistry, and Computer Science at Yale University. Thank you, Mark, for coming on.
Thank you. Sure. I had a great time.
I'd also like to thank Dr. David Thomas. He's Professor and Chair of the Department of Biochemistry at McGill University. Thank you, Dave. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark, and happy holidays and New Year to everyone. I hope we can have a show on this new broccoli, strain of broccoli that has been developed, but wasn't a point to bring it in today.
Yeah, well, I'd also like to talk about Newt. That's,
I'll talk to you later about it, yeah. Okay.
Absolutely. We'll get you on the New Year. We'll do this again. Maybe we should start the new year with the same model and make predictions for the year
for 2012. Predictions would be excellent. Yeah. As long as we don't have to have another show at the end of the year where we check up on them. Yeah.
We'll do that. I'd also like to thank Dr. Justin Sanchez, director of the Neuroprosthetics Group Research Group at the University of Miami. Thank you, Justin, for coming on.
Hey, it's always a fun time to be here.
Lastly, I'd like to thank Simon Melov, who's Associate Professor at the Buck Institute for Research on Aging. Thank you, Simon.
Sure.
And I appreciate you going to the cottage, making that trip because
it's so far.
Don't you live in Petaluma?
Yeah, it's great. It's around the corner.
Fantastic. I'd also like to thank Liz Romero for handling the audio video boards today. She did a fantastic job. Switching was amazing. There's six PhDs, and she knew everybody's name and got it all going. So I really appreciate it. And I'd also like to thank Jeff Studer, who edits the show. He's been working hard at making Futures in Biotech what it is, and keeping up the production quality. So thanks, Jeff. I'd also like to thank our chief twit, Leo Laporte, and his great team that make this possible in Petaluma, California. Comments or suggestions, I can be reached at mark, M-A-R-C, at twit.tv or on Twitter at mark Pelletier, M-A-R-C-P-L-L-E-T-I-E-R. For Futures in Biotech, I'm Mark Pelletier.